Welcome to this episode of the podcast IT42IT. My guest in this episode is an old friend of mine from the Oracle world who has been through a very interesting professional journey in the IT world. His name is Gartia. That much is clear. But Gartia, what is your last name really?
The last name that you gave me or the last name that my parents gave me?
Let's start with your parents because they were the first.
Okay. The last name, the given last name is Vaidyanatha.
Vaidyanatha.
Yes. And but you very affectionately christened me as Vahatni Hatni Hatni way back in the year 2000 or thereabouts.
That is true. That's when you and I started having serious fun together, I guess.
Yes, I don't think we have ever met and not had any fun. So I don't think this podcast is going to be any different.
Right. So, Gartia, let me just tell the listeners that basically you were born in Singapore. You ended up in Silicon Valley for many years. Then you moved to Siberia, and now you have come back from Russia with love and settled in Austin. Is that pretty much it?
That's pretty much it. But, you know, if you talk to a typical Russian who lives in the Ural area, they will tell you that they are not part of Siberia. They are part of the Ural region. Or what they called as Sverdlovsk Oblast, and Siberia constitutes 77% of Russia's landmass. So any which way you look at it, you're depending on where you are, you may be very very close to the border. And we were about 583 kilometers southwest of the old Siberian capital.
Okay.
Or 282 kilometers southwest of a town called Nitisinskoye, which is close to the 18th century Siberian border demarcation, which you can see from the highway.
It sounds like you've been on an adventure. How is it to move from the occasionally pretty cold area to the occasionally really hot area of Texas?
Well, it's awesome. I didn't realize how much Texan I was until I actually, you know, got out of the United States and then came back to Texas. The first ring of music in my ears was the word y'all, which is the abbreviation of you all. But when said with a southern twang, it's absolutely music. But I think it's useful to mention here that I did not come directly from Russia to Austin, Texas. I did make a few stops in the middle. And those stops were Hyderabad, India, Singapore, and Hong Kong.
Oh, wow. You've been around. How did you get into IT?
Well, that's an interesting question. I came to the United States in 1990, precisely the 25th of July, 1990. I landed in Los Angeles International Airport. I believe I kissed the ground when I actually got off the plane because it was such a journey just to get to the United States. So I'd come for a master's in computer science at Bowling Green State University in Ohio. And I had a bachelor's degree in business. So my first year was spent doing the prerequisites. And then I was officially enrolled in the grad school the second year, which was in 1991. And right about the middle of that year, the Persian Gulf War started and the economy went into recession. And I sort of realized that, if I had to survive because of the fact that I was on a student visa, I had to somehow find a way to get experience before I graduated. Thus, in 1992, early 1992, applied for some internships, what the immigration called as a curricular practical training. I interviewed with a few, and I was made an offer at Owens Corning Fiberglass in Toledo, Ohio. And in May of 1992, I started my IT journey at Owens Corning. And the first day that I walked in, my assigned manager was a gentleman named Mark Ames, with whom I'm in touch with even today. And one of his first questions was, hey, I know you're a C programmer, which I was at the time. Do you know Oracle? And I said, are you referring to anything in the space of fortune telling? And he laughed so hard, and he said, oh my God, okay, let me spell it out to you. Oracle's the name of a relational database. I said, really? I said, he said, so he reached out under his desk and handed me over a large three-part binder and a box of floppy disks and said, you're going to go learn Oracle.
Was this version so I started six?
This was version 6.0.31, to be precise.
Right.
So that's how my IT journey started.
You became a disk jockey, as we called them back then, because there were like 50 disks, 50 floppy disks or something.
Exactly. And invariably, the 49th one was corrupted.
I know.
And you had to erase it and order another set with Oracle Corporation on the phone, which they shipped via Federal Express. And then you had to start the journey all over again.
Yes.
Of trying to install the database.
I was in Oracle Support Denmark back then, and my friend Dino Hustings, he got hired into Support Denmark just to produce media, just to produce disks and tapes and everything else that customers needed, and patches and things that delivered physically.
Yeah, I don't think the DBAs and the developers of these days would even be able to fathom what that means or feels like, because it's a simple click on a browser and, you know, you get a tarball and off you go.
Yet another thing that has moved into real time.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, so that was your initiation into Oracle and relational database madness.
Yes, indeed.
And how did that feel for a C programmer?
It felt very liberating in one aspect and constraining on the other. The liberating aspect was that all of a sudden now I had the exposure to a Windows-based color graphical user interface. When all of the SQL statements sort of came to life in dashboards way back when.
Oh, right.
But the constraining part was, what you could do in, say, 8 lines of C code took many, many, many more lines of SQL and PLSQL to achieve. And, that part was initially a little bit frustrating, but then you kind of got to get over it and say, okay, this is how it is. It's a third generation or a fourth generation language, if you will. And it's not the same as how C is and will never be, although it is built in C, the backend engine, or was at the time. So that was the difference. But otherwise, no, it was a great opportunity to learn something new. I learned a lot about this was the era of client-server. I went one day and talked to Mark, and I said, can you please draw me a picture of what on earth is peer-to-peer computing? And he drew this beautiful picture on the board where, how the 7-layer burrito of the OSI model, mm-hmm. And so he drew that on both sides. And then I said, okay, how does our application talk to SQLNet, which in turn talks to the network, which in turn talks to the database on the other end? How does this work? And that picture is still very much green in my memory.
Right.
And so that was a great opportunity to actually see something in real world, and also to understand how peer-to-peer computing and client-server computing really worked.
Well, two I guess fun facts jump to mind right now. One, yes, PLSQL was available in Oracle forms or SQL forms, but you could code it it wasn't enforced, I guess, in the database until 7, or was it really available in 6?
No, it wasn't. I can't remember the ability
I think it was,
to write.
It was beta in the early versions of 7. So in 6, I guess you could do things, but it wasn't, you know, it didn't do anything. You had to do it in forms.
Yes, indeed.
The other thing is that Oracle, I think already from version 2 or 3, was so big and executable that they had to split it up in two parts, the user program interface and the Oracle program interface, the UPI and OPI. That was just because they just had a lot of code. And several years later, client-server becomes all the rage, and they had already split their code, so it was brilliantly easy for Oracle to suddenly do client-server, whereas Ingress, Sybase, whatever, they have to work hard to split their code.
Yep. Yeah, it somehow very easily lent itself even to talk to different networking protocols. I don't know whether you remember, you know, when we talk about networking today, the de facto, we don't even think about anything else other than TCP/IP. You know, we had all sorts of other protocols that SQLNet was supported on those days.
DECnet or DECnet.
Yes.
And the token ring.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. I think there was a LU96. There was a Novell NetWare. So there were so many other protocols that we had to sort of manage, and you know, you had to install different drivers for depending on where the application was installed for the user and what network they were part of. So that was interesting.
It was, and everything on diskettes or tapes.
yes, indeed.
Okay, so that started your journey with Oracle, and then what happened?
I guess in 1993, after a year and a half at Owens Corning, I went back to Bowling Green to finish my grad school because I, like I said, I'd done a year of prerequisites, a year of grad school at Owens Corning, did a year and a half approximately. And then I said, okay, let me just go ahead and finish up whatever was the remaining courses in my graduate program, which I did. And in May of 1994, I graduated with my master's degree. And while I was at Owens Corning, Oracle Consulting was there. And a very nice gentleman named Shub Lahiri was the lead consulting guy there. And so he and I started chatting, and he was looking at some of the work that I did. And he said, I think you should try to apply to get a consulting job. So I said, why not? So I applied, and I think in my final semester, even before I graduated, I already had the offer from Oracle to join their consulting ranks out of the Cleveland office. And that's how my journey at Oracle Corporation started. But then due to transitions in projects, different kind of, you know, skills, mismatches or whatever, I wasn't put on a project immediately. And I started looking around just within Oracle, and I saw that Oracle Education at the time was looking for instructors to teach classes. So I talked to my manager and I said, hey, while you're finding me work, can I go and go teach some classes? And he said, yeah, sure, why not? As long as you're billable one way or the other, I'm good. So that's what I did. I started teaching. That was another very interesting learning journey because I pretty much had to learn everything that I was going to go teach, without which, you're going to look pretty silly in front of 24 people in a classroom. So every class set the bar that much higher for me, and which forced me to learn and to go and try it out and break things and fix it. And while I was going through that whole process, I found that I had a great inclination towards the DBA set of courses. So I started specializing in them and teaching. And within that space, with the context of having worked and done operating systems courses at Bowling Green, I sort of felt, the space of performance tuning really helped, really is very interesting, and I want to get deeper in it. I want to specialize in it, and so I did. Interestingly enough, I never really went back to consulting full time because I was sort of teaching most of the time and then doing other things. And eventually I moved over to Oracle Education, and that's where I was till 97. And I think you and I met in 96 when you were actually designing the curriculum for the Oracle 8 software release. And that's when you walked into my world.
Yeah, me and Klaus Malt.
Yes.
We were in Support Denmark, and when they needed to create the very first Oracle 7 DBA 1 and DBA 2 materials, we volunteered. I wrote the first really, really bad chapter on constraints because I didn't have a clue, and we couldn't enforce it in the database, and it was just hell on earth. I forget what Klaus's topic was, but anyway, we wrote it. The 10 people met in New York and hammered it out over a week, and the materials got released. And then in 7.3 and 8 and 8.1 or something, they needed some upgrades, maybe later too. And Klaus and I occasionally traveled to the US, and that's where I remember we walked into you and other pretty cool people.
We met in Redwood Shores, and I think there was also Hannah Rasmussen. She was also there as part of the team. That was how we got in touch, and that's how our journey started.
Yeah, that's true. And around that time, I had a blinding insight that I had just started up premium services in Denmark, and it was going forward really fast, hiring lots of people. I think we went from 0 to 32 people in the first year from starting early 97 or something. And that constitutes about 120% of Oracle people in Denmark. So that was kind of cool. And I had a blinding insight on a ship where I read Anjo's paper on queuing and wait stuff. Mm-hmm. And I realized I had been doing tuning optimization, all that stuff, wrong. Mm-hmm. In all those years, in all those 7 or 8 or 10 years, actually, of doing all the work. Mm-hmm. And I went back to my team and I said, this is how we are going to do it. And we are going to find out details about it as we go along. But I will fire anybody who uses the old methods of guessing any kind of ratio and stuff like that.
Yep.
And I must say that you must have been one of the first ones to pick up the Oracle Web Interface thinking and starting doing crazy shit about that.
I don't know whether I was one of the first or not, but I think it was early days for many of us. I think the way it sort of all panned out for me was, as I mentioned, I was teaching at Oracle Education, and the performance tuning class was, I believe, 3 days, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep.
The problem which I had every time I taught that class, which I enjoyed that class, I loved all the bits and pieces and details and all that, but I really felt a lack, a void, something like that. And I wanted more, after teaching that class. And initially I did not know what it was, but then I realized, I said, holy smokes, we have so many ratios to check in one database to see whether it's healthy or not. How do people manage when they have, 10 databases, 50 databases, and 100 databases? Mm-hmm. I said, this is going to be an insanely boring job to go check all these ratios for 100 databases nonstop, day in and day out. Mm-hmm. And so... I believe that you were the one who actually gave me the copy of Anya Koch's YAP paper, which he co-wrote with Christy Yamaguchi and Jim Viscusi. When I read the paper, I said, this is it. And it's almost like, it was sort of the same kind of feeling that you had, where you said, we're just teaching this wrong. I mean, we're spending, it was like better half of 2.5+ days talking about ratios. And the funny thing was the whole part of the weight interface, which was sort of nestled inside the course notes, was maybe under 5 pages.
Yep.
And yet we had hundreds of pages for the other ratios, labs that checked all the ratios. And I was thinking, this is it. This is how I'm going to teach going forward. So from that day I got that paper and I read it, I basically, when I taught the performance tuning class, I basically going to say, guys, you've got 3 books. It's nice. It's good reference for you. You can check it out. It'll be very interesting in certain scenarios. But this is how we're going to actually tune an Oracle database. We are going to actually find out what is the application doing with regards to its processing, which then leads us to how's the optimizer behaving? Why did it build a plan the way it did? What were the reasons behind it? Were there the right indexes or not? Were there statistics on the right indexes or not? Because the cost-based optimizer had just, arrived in 7.3 and was barely working, as you and I know, the way we would expect it, so much so that everybody went back to the rules-based optimizer. Mm. And in version 8, it got a little bit better. And I basically said, all this additional stuff is great when you want to go drill down once you find out what is the root cause of a problem. But without that, and the funny part of it is not just checking cache hit ratios, it's going and repeatedly allocating more memory to the various shared memory structures inside the Oracle instance. And that, to me, just did not make any sense at all. And that's how I started, on the journey of teaching the tracing part. And students felt very, very comfortable. And they said, okay, this is finally something that I get, because I did not really understand how all these cache ratios would actually help me find the problem. And they were right all along. And so that's how my journey began. And once I left Oracle Corporation in 97, I just aggressively did that over and over again at every customer site that I set foot on. And eventually I think some of us got together and we called it the Oracle Weight Interface, although it was not known to be called that those days. It was just, a bunch of V-dollar tables. But that's how performance tuning came into my journey.
Right. Yeah, I thought that it was Roderick Manilak that had named it that in the 4-week internals class I had taken, where
I
saw a mentioning of it, but he denies it. Roderick strongly denies it and says it was my idea, but I cannot for the world remember that I ever came up with such a name. Anyway, it's probably also a wrong name in some aspects, but that's how it was. That's what we marketed it as, I guess, you and I and a lot of other people along the way. Anjo, of course, too. He was doing a presentation in Japan for Docomo, where he used the knowledge from his high school in the Netherlands about queuing theory. And as usual, he didn't write down anything. He just talked and wrote on a whiteboard. So Sherry, she wrote down the notes and gave them to him. And later, Jim Viscusi copied them and used them for something, I guess. So that's how it all started randomly, I guess. Yeah, I toured the world doing what they now call, I guess, did they call them advanced classes back then? Something. It was basically technical seminars along with Lex Dehaene.
It's master classes, I think.
Yeah. We started up that. Lex and I met with Klaus Andersen, who was head of education worldwide back then. We met in San Francisco with Klaus and said, could we do these technical seminars? Because they need classes for people that have already taken the standard classes. They need further education, advanced education. He said, yeah, as long as you can pay for yourself. And then I wrote the performance thing based on the weight interface, a whole day seminar, and I wrote a 2-day seminar on internals, real internals, down to C structs and stuff like that. And then I guess I toured 180 to 200 days a year for a couple of years, convincing people everywhere that the Oracle Weight Interface was the way forward. Because the documentation and the official course materials didn't reflect it.
Yes.
And yes, when you and I did our presentations at seminars, at conferences and all that, we were up against rock stars like Rick Niemitz and others that had written books and did splendid talks and very entertaining talks about tuning the wrong way. And so it was not an uphill battle. I wouldn't say that, because people loved when we talked about these things. But it was a few people to begin with against the whole Oracle world, basically. Including Oracle Corp themselves, because their technical writers didn't rewrite the manuals just by that. It took, I guess, you and Graham and JB and others to convince them, Kyle, to convince them to start changing the manuals and other things and the tools.
Yes, we changed the manuals and also changed Oracle Enterprise Manager, because that was ridden with cached ratios all over in the earlier releases. And obviously people could not understand how the tool actually provided value to solve Oracle performance problems. And so in Oracle 10G, as you mentioned, Graham Wood, Kyle Haley, James Morrell, JB, John Brezhnevich, and I were at Oracle, and we sort of said, okay, we are going to build the weight interface into the tool the way we would do it. And we came up with this concept called TOP. And when you saw the first time TOP sessions, it truly was not TOP as in the English word. TOP was actually an acronym that we used internally, called the Triangle of Performance. And the Triangle of Performance was sessions, weights, and SQL statements, because that basically was the crux of your performance tuning methodology. You wanted to go find out the most expensive SQL statement that was waiting? What was it waiting for? And which were the sessions that the SQL statement was executed in? And once you found out what it was waiting for, then you found out the resource associated with it, and then you started sort of going down the path of resolving the performance problem. Because the first issue was actually detecting what the problem is, and then diagnosing the root cause of it, and then resolving by fixing the SQL statement, and not necessarily going and allocating another gob of memory to the shared memory structures. So so I think that's where things truly changed, both within Oracle from a course material and also from a tool standpoint.
It was really cool because you were part of development, and that meant that it had weight when you came out with these new new methods. So you're right. I mean, the whole weight information was initially put in 7.0.12, but was not really official and acknowledged by Oracle until 10G, I guess.
Yes, in a way, yes, because also in 10G, Graham contributed to the world the automatic database diagnostic monitor, which is ADAM, and then there was AWR, which was the replacement for StatsPak, and then there was ASH, which is the active session history, which was basically doing what we used to do with all the X dollar tables and, you know, grabbing information from C structures. Versus, you know, the database itself providing a service that actually did that. So, I mean, and I think that was Kyle's claim to fame also. He was probably one of the first guys who wrote a program that could attach directly to the C structures exposed through the X$ table.
Exactly, because he had done that illegally before in France. In France, when he was based there at Oracle France.
Yes.
That's where I, and I can assure you that I'm going to do a podcast with him because he's doing ASH for Postgres and MySQL at Amazon, yes. I guess. Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
These days.
The performance monitoring service for RDS is pretty much under his purview.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And he's doing a great job. I think it looks very nice. And I think the other part to mention was the fact that in 10G, the database also, you know, the backend introduced the concept of a weight class, which sort of helped people to understand what was the major sort of area of focus for a given workload in a given database. Is it IO? Is it contention? Is it application specific stuff? Is it the network? And you know how it is. You know, we used to always have this joke that anytime you didn't know what the problem was, you just blame the network. You know, quite a few of us used to do that in the past. But I think with the weight interface, you actually did have quantifiable, measurable metrics that you could go back and say, yes, it is indeed the network. And it's not necessarily that the network is the problem. It's the fact that we're actually fetching the data from the query in a very inefficient manner by doing single row fetches across the wire. So I think those are, all of these bits and pieces sort of came together. It's one thing, I think it was like a collective effort. A bunch of us sort of thought this is the way people should optimize Oracle databases. people like me sort of took it to fun levels, if you will. I think at one of the conferences, I had about 450 people in the room. And, I started the session by saying we're going to have a cleansing routine first before we actually start with material, because I need to purge everything else that you know about performance tuning. And so we chanted cache hit ratios are for losers. And we did that three times. And we did that at the first conference, and it caught on. And at just about every conference, people are expecting me to do it. And I think there was one masterclass that I taught where after the masterclass, somebody who supports and subscribes to the idea of cache hit ratios actually came up to me and threatened me with a lawsuit saying that I was defaming him. And I said, no, I have nothing to do with you or your name or your company. I just know for a fact that, you know, cash atricias don't do anything. They don't tell you anything about the problem. And so, you know, the immediate gut, you know, defensive responses. I've been tuning since you were in diapers. I said, that could be a true statement, but that doesn't necessarily make your tuning method right.
Perhaps, sir, it's time to change.
Yeah, and then the rebuttal to that was, I have done latch tuning for some of the largest databases in the world. And I said, more power to you. I mean, that's awesome. But have you truly understood why we're having pressure on the latches? Is it possible that the SQL statements are causing the pressure on the latches, and shouldn't you work on that versus trying to configure more latches? So I don't know, that was those are interesting times. And I think when I, at the end of one of those presentations, one of the senior editors from Oracle Press came to me and said, you know, you need to write a book on this. And I said, are you kidding me? I mean, I have like 10 pages in my write-up. What am I going to write a book with? I mean, I can stretch it to 42 pages max, you know, and who would want to sell a book with 42 pages? And she said, no, you'll find a way to expand. And so I know I got suckered into that project, and I said, oh, okay, fine. All right, I'll write a book. And then so I was sitting there one dark November night in my home office, and I'm saying, what can I tell people that is catchy, that people will remember about this whole laundry list-based performance tuning? And then it dawned on me that, you know, this is very similar to the obsessive compulsive disorder that, which is a psychological malady that people suffer from, some people suffer from. So I said, I'm going to call it compulsive tuning disorder. And thus came into the word
CTD, which was, that was so famous back then. It really was. Yeah, that was brilliant.
It was just one. And the thing is, if all that came out of that whole book was three words, it sounds a very measly output, but I think it did the job, because people then understood that, okay, that's not the way we should tune. We got to find another way, because the laundry list-based cache ratios is not going to work in the long run, and it won't scale.
Yeah, one of the arguments I used, both to convince myself and to convince others, was this. If you present two super-duper performance tuning experts with the same data about the problem, they should arrive at pretty similar conclusions about the problem. Mm-hmm. But they couldn't possibly do that with the ratio-based madness, what I called the guess and grimacing approach back then. They couldn't possibly do that. Whereas with a scientific approach, or at least a scientific slash systematic approach based on data and based on where did the time go, you should normally arrive at the same conclusion.
Absolutely. Response time equals service time plus waiting time. I mean, that was the whole crux of the YAP paper, and that is the core mantra in performance tuning, even today, to this day, even on anything computing related, you wanna use that formula, because that makes sense.
Yeah. What is the time spent on? But I must say, as a side remark, that I was personally responsible for getting the similar kind of data into SQL Server in 2008 and 2012.
Yes.
But it hasn't caught on, because they never took, the fight, the revolution, because they had such a strong community of most valued partners and what have you, that were presenting all this ratio nonsense everywhere and had all their books tied up on it and all that. So I don't see the SQL Server world having done that. Do you?
I don't know. Maybe Kyle has done it in AWS on the RDS service. It's possible that he has, but we should ask him.
Yeah, we should. I'll ask some of the other guys in other episodes. Anyway, continue your journey, please.
Well, so we are, I think at this stage, the time frame, minus the Oracle 10G part, which came later, this whole sort of movement to use the Oracle Way interface and to optimize, diagnose and optimize Oracle that way, you know, started somewhere in the '90s and went through to the early 2000s. It was in 2000 when, you know, I was also during that time very interested in storage systems. And, you know, because I was seeing that 9 out of 10 problems that I looked at every customer site was IO related and storage related. So, you know, I delved deep into, you know, logical volume striping, mirroring, how does it work, the different levels of RAID. And I think you, a few other Oak Table members, and I actually sort of did a what we call as the BARF musical, and BARF stands for Battle Against Any RAID 5. And it's so funny that when I watched the Bohemian Rhapsody movie in the past few months, it brought back memories from those days where, you know, we used to sing Queen songs, you know, within James, the context James of...
James Moll and I sat one evening and night in my home in Molo and wrote those songs. I wrote most of them, and I came up with the, you know, there was the Queen song Radio Gaga, but if you sort of translate it into RAID IO and then Gacha, then it all makes sense. And of course we will fuck you with respect to those RAID 5 vendors and all that stuff. And when we did it couple of days later at the LaLandia conference, and you so bravely stood up and sang those songs, and the audience was just in tears of laughter. It was not from you singing, but from the text and the whole thing with all these Oak Table members on the stage singing this and that. That was fantastic. Yeah. Gotcha. And you have my eternal admiration for doing that. That must have been
the craziest thing I did in my professional world. Yes.
challenging, is that the word?
Well, you know, challenging, yeah, in some ways, but I think the underlying theme that we were fighting there, and we were fighting a different kind of issue there, was storage vendors were coming out and saying that RAID 5 was not an issue. And, you know, one should use RAID 5 and, you know, here are the reasons why. And they used to obfuscate all the performance issues by throwing, you know, a huge cache in front of the storage array. And I think our goal was to educate people and customers to say, hey, you know what? You really need to understand how RAID 5 really works. You know, how does parity get calculated? What happens if one of the disks in the volume... you know, goes out of service, you know, the rebuilding is very, very expensive. So I think all of those put together, and plus I was actually building a storage management tool for Oracle at Quest Software between 2000 and 2002. It was called Storage Expert. The ability those days, and this is way before 9i came out, was the ability to actually look at IO bottlenecks inside the object within an extent at the block level. And that was very cool and had a lot of value. But unfortunately, you know, the dot-com bubble burst and all sorts of things happened in early 2000. And so the product really never took off.
I didn't know that. First of all, I had forgotten about your whole work on that Storage Expert thing. But yeah, you got hired into Quest to do those kind of things, didn't you?
Yes. And, you know, it was a wonderful, passionate bunch of engineers based in Tel Aviv, Israel, whom I, you know, had the pleasure of visiting, you know, every other month. And it was just fascinating. You know, you saw some of these guys, and one of them, I'm still friends with a guy named Eyal Calderon, as opposed to Eyal Arnof, who was the CTO at the time. So Eyal Calderon was just a mind-blowing engineer because, you know, he figured out how to actually trap a system call and pause it and grab the parameters of the system call and then let it go. All within a fraction of a microsecond. And, you know, on Solaris, the guts of it was a call called WSTOP, which, you know, I was just floored. I said, wow, this is the level of talent that these guys have. And that's why StorageX was a very, very lightweight tool on the database. The database never even, you know, had a hiccup. You install the, when you install the actual agent, there was no overhead. Because it never hit any $V tables. It never hit any $X tables. It just was looking at the shared memory structure and just pulling, you know, looking at the system call coming through and just pausing it for a fraction of a microsecond, grabbing the parameters and letting it go. And that was just mind-blowing stuff. And this is why I thought that, you know, and then we built plugins for the EMC Symmetrix. There was stuff coming for NetApp and others, but, you know, that was one of my, I would say, pet projects, which never sort of got off the ground in the true sense.
It must have been an extreme learning curve.
Oh yeah, it was fantastic. I learned more about storage arrays, volumes, and to the point where I actually, you know, I had some experience in actually implementing a data warehouse on RAID 3 on the Origin 2000 server, which is running IRIX. And that was like a total, absolutely mind-blowing server that did real-time video streaming way back when, processing video files, and was perfectly, you know, tailor-made for a data warehouse. But, you know, they couldn't market their way out of all the other mess. They were trying to make NT workstations and selling it for, you know, $840,000 maybe a few thousand bucks when Dell was pretty much having laptops with NT for a fraction of the cost. And you'll never survive when you have that kind of a business model. So a lot of good technologies, a lot of companies that just did not quite change with time, did not adapt and learn from the market forces. You know, people thought Linux was not going to stick. You know, just continued down their own path of proprietary operating systems. Yeah. Look where Sun Microsystems doesn't even exist anymore.
Yeah, that's true.
And so I think, and my heart goes out to Digital Unix. My goodness, Deck Alpha, what a fantastic server. What a fantastic platform that was.
That was my background. And I consistently tell people I have not worked on a better operating system in many respects. But yeah, that doesn't mean that it won.
No. Yeah, Vax VMS was a great operating system, but Digital Unix was a great operating system. I believe it was the first POSIX compliant or near POSIX compliant. And it was an offshoot from the old Cray. These servers, these databases never went down. I ran one of those for a year and a half. It did not. We didn't even reboot it for a year and a half. They just couldn't embrace the change that was coming. And as a result, you know, Deck got sold to Compaq, and then Compaq became part of, you know, HP and whatever else happened after that. I mean, it died on the...
Except for Digital Equipment Corporation's databases, because they got sold to Oracle.
RDB, yes.
Yeah. And I still think it's one of the better takeovers I've seen, because they basically left the so-called New England Development Office alone. They let them continue developing new features for RDB. and even for the non-relational databases too. And they are still available on the price list.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. They are.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it is. So, okay, so that was sort of your .com period in some ways.
Yeah, and then finished up with the Oracle 10G in late 2003. And then in early 2004, I sort of had this, itch in me to say, okay, I think I need to do consulting on my own, choose the projects that I want to work on and, just forget about all the other BS and just deliver value for the customer, take care of the customer. And so, DB Perfman was launched in 2004.
What is that?
DB Perfman stands for Database Performance Management, and was basically a very small boutique consulting firm that helped people solve performance issues, both in the proactive side and the reactive side. The proactive side was more the design work of building scalable backend architectures, scalable schema designs. The proactive part was getting people out of trouble, more of the triage, firefighting, some website production system is grinding to a halt because of some bad piece of code. So you go, you find it, you trace the sessions, you find the SQL, you fix the SQL. Sometimes you have to do some backend sort of, stuff with partitioning tables just to make sure that we're not consuming more I/O than what we need to. But all of that was fun, and it lasted. We had a great run, 11 profitable years up to 2015. And in 2015, that was like a year of awakening for me in more ways than one. A voice sort of inside me basically sort of said, you know what, you're going to get out of your comfort zone. Because starting in 2012 itself, I started seeing the writing on the wall. Consulting demand had sort of diminished, and the graph was pointing downward. And I did not want to be in denial and, hanging on to something which I knew was not going to work in the future. So I got out of my comfort zone, and I just let go of fear, because that was the first thing you want to be able to sort of let go of, the fear of the unknown of everything. Because, after working with relational databases for 25 years or 23 years at the time, you basically said, I need to know other things. I cannot be one-dimensional in my skills with a two-dimensional database, to your point. that's what sort of, I sort of took stock with life and everything else that was going on. And I said, I need to do something completely different, which means two things. One, I'd already sort of embraced the cloud computing sort of wave, because I knew that was pretty much going to be the future of computing. And data centers were just, shutting down pretty much on a monthly basis with even the customers that I knew. I said, okay, I was born in Singapore, obviously. You mentioned that earlier. So I wanted to go and work in Asia. And specifically, I had this, sort of desire to work in financial services. I don't know why that was the case, but so I shut down everything and I went, first spent a year in Russia and then went to Singapore, spent a little bit of time on the way in Hyderabad, and then finally in Hong Kong. And it was during that period when I was faced with this issue of someone asking me to build a data integration, a database that just integrated data from 42 different backend systems, believe it or not.
Okay.
And I said, my first question was, okay, great. Yeah, I can do that. Where's your enterprise data model? At the physical level. And they looked at me as though I was talking some kind of foreign language. And and then I said, oh, so you don't have an ERD at the physical level. Okay. We need to create one. And so this is 40 different systems across the world. And I said, it's going to take their half of a year plus, maybe close to 18 months to get this done. And here's the sad part. When I'm done with it, it'll be obsolete. Because in the 18 months, because the business would have changed in 18 months. What is the point of creating something that takes that long? Because in today's day and age, it's going to be different in 18 months and it's going to be obsolete. So they said, no, that can't, you can't do that. So I said, I believe there is a way. And the way is having a NoSQL database as a data integration platform, because it has the ability to support schema drifts, to support inconsistencies in column names across different databases, because we can do the process of canonicalization and standardization and harmonization. And you know, this is like the great seal of the United States. It says e pluribus unum. E pluribus unum means out of many one. And that's exactly what data integration is. Out of many different backend sources, you're creating one from which people can sort of feed data to the enterprise. And so that was a fantastic journey because, and I wrote about it on LinkedIn, Confessions of a Relational Bigot, my journey from Oracle to NoSQL. And so when I looked around, I found that the database that I was most impressed with out of the non-cloud databases that were out there at the time was MarkLogic. And so I played with it. I learned. There were a few folks from MarkLogic who answered a plethora of questions that I had. And I finally found a way to map relational to non-relational to NoSQL. And that is fundamental in data integration because you know it better than anyone else that anytime a schema changes, the first problem is how do you add that column in a production database without bringing down the website? You have the runtime issues based on load and everything and the latches that are required, the dictionary latches that are required to perform the operation at the object level. And then once, let's assume that that does get done successfully, then the whole issue of how do you prevent the SQL statements from breaking? Because now you have this additional column. And if you have a select star somewhere, now you're returning data back. And if you need to put the data somewhere, and now that's not going to work because you don't have that receptacle for this additional column. Now, if that was not bad enough, then you have the ETL problem to solve because all your ETL programs break. If that wasn't enough already, now you have replication to fix because now your replication all breaks because of this additional column. So all of this sort of, has sort of compounded this whole issue of businesses constantly thinking IT cannot deliver value with data because it takes too long to get anything done. And that's where the concept and the foundation of NoSQL databases comes in, because NoSQL database truly helps us build something that can support schema drift, because now I can create a multi-level, multi-dimensional business object in JSON format, in document format, and serve that document over a REST endpoint to an application, which then can process everything between the starting curly brace and the ending curly brace, and it knows what columns and what values. So I think this is where fundamentally things change. It is not, and believe me, this is like changing my religion, trying to go work with NoSQL. But it had to be done, because until and unless you have a well-defined ERD at the physical level, there's no way you can build something that can provide that integration. And I think that's where that learning sort of experience started. And I'm very glad it did. I'm very glad the universe put me in that position because it allowed me to grow. It allowed me to embrace cloud-based NoSQL services. It allowed me to learn AWS in more detail. And I think even despite all of the relational learnings and 2.5+ decades of doing relational, it's important to keep the door open and saying, okay, I need to learn something every day because you know, otherwise I'm going to become obsolete myself. So I think that's the background theme behind sort of everything that went through and happened in my life at that stage.
Okay, so basically the headline is that you have seen, quote unquote, the light regarding NoSQL, and it sounds to me like you have found out that it can solve all those messy problems that we have in the relational world and in the multi-system world in a sort of messy way, because it's created in a totally different manner from the strict RDBMS thinking that we were brought up with.
Yeah, absolutely, because you can't in your right mind go and start doing joins between two different collections or two different tables in a NoSQL environment. Yeah, will it work? Yeah, but it won't work very well. So you have to think business objects, right? You have to think what does the application need? So, you know, in our world, in the relational world, we used to sort of create the data structure, design the schemas, create everything, and then we used to go build the applications after. Here you sort of have to go the other way. You have to say, what does the application need? What are the business objects that we need? I cannot do joins at runtime, right? It's very, very expensive, and it's the anathema of NoSQL if you're going to try to do joins at runtime. So here you're thinking, okay, how? And this is, you know, if you think about it, it is not that different than what we used to do, albeit in a different context. In the relational world, when we had a performance problem that was cannot be solved due to tuning a SQL statement or rewriting a SQL statement or even doing something with indexing, we basically said, okay, there is this problem with volume of data that we are processing. There is a skew in this volume because depending on what are the where clause predicates, the performance is different. You sort of step back and say, okay, this is a case to build a star schema. I'm going to create a denormalized fact table with keys and aggregated values, and then I'm going to have normalized dimensions that tie into it. Thereby, I don't have to optimize for one single dimension because every dimension will work. There'll be only two joins to go from any dimension to the other. And I think if you look at NoSQL, a complex multi-dimensional object inside NoSQL is just that. You basically can have a specific order and all line items for that order enclosed within one specific object, right? I'm just giving you a simple example. And you can do that, and you have that without a join. So which means then now when you need that doc, you're just saying, "What? Give me this, for this customer, give me this specific order." And you get that document. You get the customer ID, you get all the orders in the doc and the line items for that specific customer. And that is where the power of NoSQL comes into play. It is basically star schema on steroids, looked in a different way.
This is very, very interesting. It sounds like it will be about as difficult to convince people about this as it was convincing them about, you know, optimizing in a different way back in those days. Have you tried so far to convince people that this is a way to go?
The proof's in the pudding, right? I mean, people are used to relational databases. People are used to certain types of data consumption. And I'm not saying everything has to be done with NoSQL. Don't get me wrong. There is a time and a place where there are dashboards that require data to be processed in rows and columns. And for that, by all means, data for those specific business objects, you know, those need to be materialized as rows and columns. But I think if you look at a mobile application, if you're looking at, for example, you're in financial services and you're building a mobile app, and when someone logs into the mobile app, they get to see information about them, what kind of accounts they have with you, what kind of positions they have in your accounts, the amount of wealth they have. I mean, those things are sort of tailor-made for, those kind of applications are tailor-made for the NoSQL space, because to do the same thing with SQL will take a significant number of queries to populate just that first page. And that means that the app is going to be slow. So have I had trouble convincing people? Well, it depends on who the audience is. The audience is more open to the idea of looking at data persistence as not a single-dimensional aspect. And when I say single-dimensional, I'm talking about there's only one solution. You know, it's like the classic hammer and the nail problem, right? Versus people saying, data has changed. It's not just, strings and dates and numbers anymore. We have all sorts of different types of data. We have documents, we have images, we have video clips, we have audio clips, we have social media data, we have log data, which is how did a customer use the website? So there are logs generated, So there's so many different types of data, not to mention IoT data where relevant. And so how do you take all that? How do you take a video and stick it into a relational database? You can't. We know that the relational database supports blobs, but you know that after beyond a certain point for a video file, you are going to store it out of line. So why bother putting it inside a relational database? Why don't you just have a pointer there and says, okay, store the video in a blob service, or let's say, for example, an AWS like an S3 storage bucket, and then get the pointer to it and then process the blob as required when you need it. So I think, it takes a different mindset. And if you are thinking that relational is the only way that you can actually process and deliver data and generate analytics from it, then yeah, I'm going to have a hard time convincing you. But if you're open to the idea and you understand that data is different, how we process data and what kind of data we processed 20 years ago versus what we're doing today is quite different, then you'll be open to the idea of saying, okay, I need it for purpose. If I'm going to do relationships, I need a graph database. If I need key value pair or documents, then I'm going to go with a NoSQL database, right? So if I need a large scale, SQL based analytics, I can go to a columnar database. And there are services in AWS and Azure and everyone else for each of these. And it makes sense to use those services because otherwise, it's like the hammer and everything is a nail problem. And more often than not everything is a nail.
But how did you stumble upon NoSQL databases, Katya?
It was just, I think necessity is the mother of invention, right? I was literally tearing my hair apart for, I think, a period of 2 or 3 weeks where I was trying to solve this problem of how do I integrate data from 42 different systems, 42 different databases, where the table names and column names are all different, right? I have to create some kind of mapping somewhere. And what happens if a column changes? What happens if a column gets dropped? What happens if a column gets renamed? What happens if a column is added? What happens if a column is modified where the length is increased or decreased or whatever it is, right? How do I manage that? Because imagine this, if you have one database and you've got 100 tables and each table has got 10 columns on an average, you've got 1,000 columns in one database. Now times 42, you've got 42,000 columns that you have to deal with. How do you manage that within the relational space in a dynamically changing environment where things change, right? Mm-hmm. And when you start building static models, you kind of look at it and you say, no, this is wrong, right? You can say, I'm going to build a relational table where I'm going to have the data dictionary associated with the column, in the table itself. So I have 100 columns in the table, and I'm going to have data about the data, which is metadata, as a column next to that specific column. So now you have the table of 200 columns. That's great if your table has got 100 columns, but what if your table has got 400 columns? Now you're going to make it 800 columns. It just gets very kludgy. And then people say, oh, you know what? Oh, you can store JSON documents inside relational databases. Yeah, you can do that. But truly, is that analogous to putting a square peg inside a circle, which sort of is, because because then you have to create a virtual column, because you have this huge blob of, you know, blob of text inside this column. You have to create virtual columns to identify which are the columns that you want to search on. Then you create virtual indexes on those columns. Really, do we really want to complicate life that much? That's what got me going. Every time I tried to solve it with the relational space, I hit a wall. And I said, this won't work. It cannot, it won't scale in the long run. And I don't want to put my thumbprint on something where I build it, it works for 6 months, and then it breaks after that. So then I said, okay, I need to look at this differently. And so I started looking at, you know, I know people have looked at document databases and key value pairs in a different context. I said, what if we could use this for a data integration platform? It just came as a what if. And then I started playing with it, and then I started seeing the value behind it, and then it started to work. And then I said, okay, cool, this is it. This is one application of a NoSQL database, is an environment where column names are different across different databases, data silos, and I'm trying to make it all look like one on a data integration platform.
In some ways, gotcha, it sounds like, well, basically, embracing the chaos due to all the systems, and instead of trying to enforce the strictness of relational theory.
Yes, indeed. And that is where I think, you know, people sort of, when they have not done it, they probably will not be able to appreciate it as much. If you had the choice, the ideal thing to do is to rename every single column in all of your 42 systems to the standard, right? Mm-hmm. Once you do that, then everyone is, you know, if I've got a table called customer and the identifier is customer underscore ID, then it's customer underscore ID in every single system, right? Mm-hmm. But that is not reality, my dear friend. You know that, right? Mm-hmm. It's cust ID in one place. It's cust underscore ID in another place. It's customer ID spelled out in another place. How can I build something that takes all these different cust ID names and make it look and feel like one based on the corporate metadata standard? The way to do that is to create a data integration platform that basically harmonizes all of those differences and uses the standard metadata lingo that people have established in the CDO's office and implement that on the integration hub.
This is really interesting. This is really, to me, fresh thinking. One thing is that you are saying cloud, you're saying serverless, and you're saying NoSQL, but basically you're also saying integrating relational systems, including many relational systems, very many relational systems, using this approach, isn't it?
Yes, many, many relational systems and also non-relational systems. And if you can give me the soapbox on that one for just a couple of minutes, I don't like the way data has been delineated as structured, semi-structured, and unstructured, because for me, there is structure in every piece of data. There is nothing to say that a weblog is unstructured. It has very good, clean structure. Now, we may not store it inside a relational table for reasons of performance because of volume and retrieval times, but that doesn't necessarily make a weblog unstructured. So I think the way I sort of differentiate is there is data that needs to live inside a relational table, and there is data that has no business living inside a relational table, and those are we call as non-relational data. And those non-relational data sources can be stored either in blob storage, in document databases, in graph databases, and whatever else that we want. Because I think that's the mindset we have to have. We cannot have this one way that we should do everything and stuff everything into this one specific persistence model. I think that's where I think those things, we were able to do that in the past because, you know, it was relational and nothing but relational those days. And believe me, if I could do anything with a relational table, I would have, and I have. But those days are gone. You can't do that anymore because it won't work. It won't scale.
because a lot of different data came along.
Correct.
Or was it there already, but we just ignored it or tried to make it fit our relational minds?
I don't think we did, because think about it, right? Today, if I ask you, model a customer business object for me, you would say, okay, there are relational components, name, address, you know, age, date of birth, passport number, blah, blah, right? Mm-hmm. So that's all relational stuff, pretty simple, straightforward. What about things like, how many times did the customer interact with us? What are all mm-hmm. the different channels that the customer interacted us with, right? Did he or she send us documents during onboarding? Did he or she send their photographs during onboarding? Mm-hmm. Did we have a Skype call or some other voice over IP platform call? Did a chatbot exchange messages with them? Did we ourselves, as relationship managers in a financial services firm, exchange messages with our customer, right? Mm-hmm. How did the customer navigate through our website? What is the customer saying about us on LinkedIn, on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram? Tell me 25 years ago, we had none of these, the last parts.
Right.
Now, today, when you're talking about customer management and you're talking about understanding a customer and you're talking about the 360-degree view of customer, you need to understand all of these different pieces. Where are all your touch points with your customer? What are all the different channels with which your customer communicates with you? And that way you understand how to provide the highest level of service to the customer. And this cannot be done. Everything stuffed into a relational table. And that is where I, you know, sort of went the way of finding a way to do it. And NoSQL came to the rescue. Because now I'm able to create a business object, a nested business object, which has the address, all the personal information, and then that has URLs for specific, you know, blob storage buckets, S3 buckets, one for the documents, one for the photographs, for the images, one for the calls, one for the text messages. And now when someone says, tell me what we did with this customer on the 18th of, you know, December, I can very quickly read the base customer business object, pick up all of the information that I need, and hit basically individual URLs within the non-relational data parts to see whether is there anything on 18th of December, and very quickly say, yeah, we had an exchange of text messages, and here it is. Here's what we discussed on the 18th of December. Mm-hmm. And I think that is where things are different these days. And not to mention this whole idea of the serverless, which, to be very honest, right? IT and professional life and work became so much more fun after cloud computing came about because things were different. We sort of had to do things the old way. You know, we had to write code. It's not about installing third-party software for every problem that you had. It's about doing things the simplest way. It's about decoupling. It's about abstraction. It's about asynchronous execution. It's about automatic scaling, right? It's not about waiting 3 months to get a server, right? All of these.
So that also, you know, moved towards real time.
Yeah, exactly. And it needs to be, right? It makes sense, right? Remember those days where all of us, I think James, you, myself, everyone, we used to go to eBay. We used to go on eBay to buy servers that we could wire and put it on our garage so that we can have some of our fun projects, right? Mm-hmm. We don't need to do that anymore because, who wants to blow up the garage? You know, for those of us who don't know how to wire properly, we may end up blowing all kinds of fuses in the garage and burning the house down. Mm-hmm. And then your wife comes back and says, what happened to the house? Well, I was trying to wire my computer system and I burned it down. That's where things change, right? I want to play with something. I want to play with a specific type of database, a specific type of machine. I can go on my AWS account, revision it, play with it, and then toss it, and then I'm done. And I think that is huge. You can't wait 3-6 months to get a server and install software and wire and, you know, stack and rack it up and all that. I mean, those days are all gone. And I think this whole idea of serverless takes it to a different level, because we're not saying there's no servers. We're just saying that we're not going to pay for idle time anymore. We don't want to manage these servers because they can become very, very messy. We want to make sure that we pay what we use, truly. And I think that's where data management also, because data management is not a 24/7, 365. Every second you're getting 1,000 API calls. You know, that's not how data integration hubs work. Data integration hubs work certain times where, you know, you get your batch extracts, you get real-time extracts through streams, through a PubSub model. It's very sporadic, and there are lots of, you know, pockets of quiet time in a day. My question is, in a 24-hour day, if you're using your system only for 8 hours, why are you paying for the other 16? That's the fundamental question. And it's not just about cost, right? It's about management. It's about patching. It's about installs. It's about upgrades. You don't need to do that, because every time you ask for to run a Python program on, say, AWS Lambda, you're getting, and say, I want it on Python version X, you're getting the latest and the greatest version X installed in a micro container where it launches your code, runs your code, and then once your code is done executing, it goes away. And you pay for the time, for the execution time. And I think that's where serverless computing has sort of taken off. And there are lots of sites out there that actually use serverless computing. I'm not saying everything needs to be serverless, but I'm just saying that it just changed the way we even think about it. So much so, AWS has a serverless version of Aurora for sporadic activity, for batch jobs that need the database only for 2 hours.
So it's kind truly, of use it's truly pay as you go.
Exactly. You pay for the storage 24/7, which is fine.
I thought initially that cloud computing was all about pay as you go. And now I realize that now that they've introduced the buzzword serverless, they are actually trying to implement what I thought was the whole idea. Namely, you only pay for the resources you use.
Well, I think the original definition of that is that they were assuming that when you are done with working your 32 vCPU machine with whatever experiment that you were doing, if you decommission or deprovision your instance, then yeah, you're paying only what you use for. But most production systems are not like that. We don't deprovision our servers every night just because we're going back home. The servers are still there. They're still running. They're not doing much. If they're running a database, they're not doing much other than the database is running, but no one's connecting, no one's doing anything. But I think this whole idea where serverless computing has come to play is that you truly don't have idle servers that you need to be worried about from a cost standpoint. They might be there in the background, but you don't see it, and you don't have to worry about it, you don't have to manage it, and you pay only for the time that you used. And I think that is truly where cloud computing should be and is.
Yeah, that's gotta be the standard in moving forward. I don't see any alternatives. That's gotta be the standard. But it of course requires cool technology in the server centers, in the data centers. Sorry, it requires some fast connections and enough capacity and all that stuff.
Yeah, indeed. And I think there are some vendors who actually use the word serverless in the wrong way to their own benefits. But truly, we're talking about if you don't pay for the time that you don't use and you don't have to manage those servers and you don't see them or you don't care about them, they're not in your radar, then you're truly talking about serverless. Otherwise, it becomes like a managed service that is out there like a pass, where things are running, you're seeing the servers, you have to manage them or whatever.
So you're basically talking about a world where we don't need to think at all about servers.
No. Think about it, right? The last time, when we used to do it, right? We've had our share of systems that we've pretty much, racked and stacked from the ground up. We literally had to start with the waiting for the truck to arrive, the hardware gets offloaded in the dock, And then we push it into the data center, and then it gets wired first, or the networking team gets involved, just the physical wiring. And then you say, okay, yeah, great. Now let's go try to crank this up, install the operating system, and then, then install other things, then patch it, then maintain it for... Who wants to do that anymore? Because, if you look at it, right, let's say you're working for, the healthcare industry. Your core competency is healthcare. Your core competency is not patching operating systems, right? I mean, even if you're in the IT organization of a healthcare organization. So I think that's where I'm saying those kind of things need to, you got to let go. Those things you don't need to do anymore. Because I want the latest and greatest server that is out there, a container, what have you, running a version of Python, because I have this piece of code that I want to run. And every time I run it, I don't care about what version of the operating system is being used and what are the packages, whether I need to do a yum install or this or that or the other. I don't really care. I want to run my code. And I want that code to do something because it has business value.
You're fighting compulsive server disorder.
Exactly. Compulsive server management disorder also, because people always think that when they have their server and they touch and feel it, they have control over it. And well, that's a different age and an era.
You gotta let go.
You gotta let go. And it's the same thing with people who are afraid to go to the cloud also, right? They keep saying that, it's out there, it's up in the cloud. It is, but chances are it's way more secure in the cloud if you follow the best practices, if I may use the word best practice for today.
Mm-hmm. You may for a limited amount of time.
Yeah, I mean, it's the most reasonable things you should do to actually...
No, it's the smart choice. It's the basic professional thing to do.
Yeah, because people sometimes live under this illusion that just because their servers and their systems are within the firewall, that it's safe somehow. And once it goes outside the firewall, that it's not safe. And if you look at the sort of the root cause of most data breaches, there was an inside job, most of it. There is somebody on the inside who actually opened the door just wide enough so that someone could get in.
For many reasons, I do not like McKinsey, but 10, 15 years ago, they told Danish customers, don't you think that your data might be safer in a big American data center than in your little personal data center here? And that to me was a moment of truth. Mm. Most of these guys truly have better abilities to handle our data and stuff than we have ourselves. So it's not even there might be concerns about, Where does the data reside or whatever, blah blah blah, and some political things too. But there's no turning back. It's the way it goes. I was reminded a couple of minutes ago about an old friend of mine. She's about my age. She told me a story 2 years ago, 3 years ago, that her mom, who was obviously much older than you and me, were having a conversation with her husband. And her husband was really nervous after having read an article in some newspaper, some uninformed article about the cloud and all that. And she said, no, my dear husband, your data is in heaven. And she says that her father felt much safer, much better about the data. So I think in some contexts, we should probably use the word heaven instead of cloud.
Mm. Good enough.
So, Katja, this immense mental journey of yours, how are you going to change people and organizations and the world with this? Are you going to write a book? Are you going to do presentations? Are you going to do masterclasses? What are you going to do?
uh, That's interesting. Well, I think I'll start with publishing on LinkedIn articles, and you know, for those people who care to read, they can pick up you know, the content, and then we can have some interesting discussions around it. I'm not so sure I'm going to write a book because you know, I don't think at this stage I have the time for it. With reference to the masterclass, well, yeah, maybe a day's worth of data integration. That might be interesting. Love to do it. I'd love to share what I have, what I've learned, and but I think it's important for people to sort of understand that the old guard has changed, and the way we manage data has changed, and the types of data we manage has, you know, changed. Not just the volume of data, which we know it's just exploded, but it's just the types of data that we handle is also changed, and it's becoming quite varied and diverse. And it's important that we sort of don't resist that change, because change, ironically, is the most permanent thing.
Are you going to create a meetup in Austin about these things?
Yeah, that might be a good idea. I think I might want to go to a data science meetup and share my thoughts, and you know, maybe if there is enough demand for a separate meetup for data integration, that'd be my pleasure to launch that.
I am currently thinking that I need to think a little more about this, because this has really opened my eyes to many opportunities. But I think it would be cool to have you do some kind of masterclass or inspiration thing or examples or things, either remotely or here for some of our big entities here, because this is exactly what they suffer from. The worst problem they really have is sometimes to integrate 42 systems or more. But the second and about as big problem is that their systems are actually truly integrated or interconnected. They are woven together so that you cannot replace one system with a newer solution.
Yeah, they are suffering from the problem of coupling.
Yes. Yep. And, you know, you and I have been married. We know what that problem is.
Yes.
But do you see these new ideas of yours being able to solve the coupling problem also?
When we start talking about cloud and serverless, one of the fundamental tenets of cloud computing is decoupling, because you want to be able to individually scale each service or each function. I think there's a very good quote from the CTO of Amazon, Dr. Werner Vogels. He says that I'm going to paraphrase what he said, but he basically said, everything that can break will break, right? So you have to architect and design and build for that. And the other sort of nugget of wisdom, which is pretty obvious if you think about it, but he brought out, was saying, always contain the blast radius. I think that is important, because if you don't contain the blast radius, then you have a cascading effect of basically bringing down the entire system. And you and I have worked with enough problems with multi-instance databases, that where a problem in one instance, in one specific instance, you know, somehow does not gets propagated to the other instance, and eventually there's a problem with the other instance also. And I think that blast radius containment is extremely important. And given that as a foundation, any of your customers that you're talking to have to sort of look at the sort of the journey to the cloud as a way to re-architect and decouple their services, because the whole coupling monolithic model worked when you had one server and you had control over it. That kind of goes away once you move to the cloud. And it's not that you've lost control. It's just that it is not architected that way. And it is not good to architect that way, because why would you want all of the services to fail and suffer just because one service had a problem, but because you didn't contain the blast radius, it went all the way out. I think that's where things are different. And that's where people have to rethink how to truly go to the cloud and re-architect workloads which they have and completely aggressively decouple interdependencies. It's critical that we do that.
Wow. That's revolutionary, of course. Hereditary, actually.
No, but it's, if you think about it, it's not. I mean, that's what the cloud, everyone in the cloud does that. It's not revolutionary anymore. It used to be, but it's not. Because if you don't do that, then you truly are not embracing cloud computing the way it's supposed to, work for you. Because what is the point of taking all of your on-prem servers, sticking it into virtual machines on the cloud, and having the same mess that you had on-prem on the cloud? What is the point? Yes, there are certain things you can lift and shift. There are certain things that you cannot re-architect. I understand that. Third-party ERP applications, you're not going to sit and re-architect, although you wish you could in some cases. But for most part, the non-ERP, the non-third-party stuff, you need to make sure that you're actually leveraging what's available out there. And why would you do this without putting some thought into the process of how do I do this better? How do I do this more cost efficient? How do I do this so that it's scalable? Because if you cannot predict your workload, if your workload is constant and is exactly the same every single day, yeah, we can pre-provision, boom, all is good. But let's say you have a dynamic workload. Let's say it's good on some days, bad, good and bad as far as the volume. If the volume is really high and all of a sudden you're running out of gas in your servers, historically, what do? We just sit there and wait. We let for the storm to pass. In the cloud environment, it automatically scales up so that there is no storm. And I think that is important. And I think to be able to design your services and your data persistence and your processing layers correctly, keeping that in mind, is critical. Because it doesn't work otherwise. Because you don't find the Airbnbs and the Ubers and the all of the other disruptors of the world do static provisioning and say, okay, I think this is how it is and this is how it will be. Everything is built to fail, designed that it will fail. And there are resiliency built into it so that they recover from the failures. And they recover and they learn from it and make sure that you don't make the same mistake again if there is a problem or a bug in the software or any other architectural deficiencies that you may have. So I think that's critical. That's a mindset change. And it's the old way of doing it is no longer relevant.
So basically, failure is an option.
Absolutely. It is an option and it will be part of your world. And I think one great thing which I think people haven't done so is to learn more about chaos engineering. It's something that...
What is that?
Fantastic thing that the guys at Netflix actually started, where they literally sit down and break things and see what is the blast radius, what is the impact.
Gotcha. Sorry for interrupting you. This is kind of a variation over our friend Jonathan Lewis's old anthem about testing to destruction.
Yes, it is. They have this thing called the Chaos Monkey. There's a Chaos Gorilla. And then there is King Kong. So they're different, you know, you have these different chaos days where you sit down and you break things. And you break things and you learn and you see how things, what you need to do. You automate the parts of the things that break. You learn. And this is how the systems become more robust and resilient over a period of time. So, you know, chaos engineering is something that every IT organization has to engage in. Because if you sit down and wait for the problem to show up, you will not know what to do when it does show up. And granted, there are problems in this world that you may not have anticipated. And this is, goes way beyond testing. This is not testing. This is not your unit test, functional test. No, 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 no. That's all done and dusted, finished. Here, what you're doing is you're literally, you know, bringing down a service. You're unplugging things. You're removing networking that gives you access. You're removing a proxy server that gives you access to a specific region or a specific, you know, availability zone, whatever it is, right? You're breaking things intentionally and to see how does your system, you know, handle that and what is the impact for your customers? Because if you don't do that, then chances are your customers are going to experience outage on your systems on a regular basis. And that is not done anymore these days.
So it used to be that you and I, when we did testing at companies, we really never did true testing because, you know, testing the true time it would take for a backup to restore the whole system, or testing what if we took down everything in one go or things like that. We never dared do that. The testing was always very controlled, wasn't it?
In many cases, it was. But I'll tell you that I think one of the most stressful, heart-stopping events for some of the people that I worked with is basically during our so-called, we didn't call it chaos engineering those days. We just called it the day that we test our failover, right? We used to have those failover testing on a regular basis. So I literally have done this where I could have literally gone and we've taken offline a disk drive from the primary volume of the storage array to simulate a failure and say, okay, now what? Right? And that's the kind of stuff that we are doing these days, albeit in the cloud services realm, because we don't touch any physical hardware anymore. But yeah, I mean, reading a backup from tape was one of the fundamental things that DBAs had to do to test, to see whether the backup is readable or not. And more often than not, you found that your tape was corrupted, and what use is a backup if you can't read from it?
Yeah.
So, but all those, I think, we've gotten better with that because, you know, you have very, very durable storage available in the cloud these days. Like S3 has got, I think, 11 nines durability.
Yes.
So yeah. Chances are you will never lose your data if you put it in an S3 bucket. But I think what's important is for you to look at the bigger picture. What happens if you simulated a DDoS on your primary website? What happens if something goofy happens at the networking layer? All those things have to get tested. And so it's like this, like the monkeys in the room, in the engine room, and the monkey puts a spanner into the works, right? You've heard that term. Mm. And chaos engineering is about intentionally creating chaos and breaking things and learning from what broke, why did it break, and how to avoid the breakage in the first place. And if the breakage cannot be avoided, then how do you heal from it within a reasonable period of time? And so we did not have any room to do that apart from the backup and recovery and the failover testing that we used to do. But I think these days with dozens of services, hundreds of services on the cloud, you need to do that. You need to literally simulate failures for each of those services which is in your stack and see what happens to the entire system.
So do you think in a mental way that some of us in the Oak Table have been chaos engineering all the time?
Some of us, in some ways, yes, we have. Jonathan's idea of, doing it till destruction is definitely in line with chaos engineering. We just didn't call it that.
I've been accused of similar things by ex-wives, but that's another story.
No. Let's keep this technical, my dear friend.
Yes. Well, I am. Gotcha. This has been way too fun. And we are approaching 1 hour and 50 minutes. This is ridiculous. We need to talk more and we need to do more episodes about this stuff. But I need to consume this and put this into a couple of episodes or something. I cannot, it's too interesting what you're talking about. So I would like to sort of wrap it up here now, and then I think we should talk about some future episodes about what it is that you're doing and thinking. It's been really enlightening for me, to be honest, really enlightening. And I think you're onto something really important about integration in an impossible age.
Thank you. I feel that I'm onto something, but I just need to get some traction. But it'll come. It'll come at the right time.
What do you think? How it is? What do you think your new chant should be instead of buffer cast hit ratios are for losers? What could be the new chant? Or one of the new chants?
One of the new chants could be integrate or go out of business. I don't know. I don't want to make it too morbid by saying integrate or die, but I think integrate or go out of business is definitely, because truly, if you don't have a full 360 degree view of your customer, your products, your transactions, your services, everything that, that those are critical, pieces of the business, how are you going to serve your customers? I mean, it's not possible to do that. And I'll give you a very short story quickly. I used to be a platinum card holder of a very famous credit card here in the United States. And they used to send me this gold card offers on a monthly basis. So I used to just toss it into the recycling bin. And one day it just got under my skin. I said, okay, I'm going to call these people because I want to know what is their thought process. So I called and I said, hey, I've got this offer for a gold card, blah, blah, blah. And oh, yeah, gold card is fantastic. I said, no, hang on, stop. Do you know what kind of card I hold right now? And there was this pregnant pause on the line. And then I said, so you do not have any idea what kind of card I hold, and yet you're sending me a gold card. And then I hear this, fearless typing in the background where I know that, she's trying to instant message, trying to get some information. And then a minute passes and she says, you are a platinum card holder. I said, who told you that? I have a friend who told me that. I said, uh-huh. I said, and why is that you didn't know that yourself? And then, so again, another pregnant pause. And then I said, okay, let me tell you. I think I know what the answer is. You belong to the marketing and upsell business division, and you are running a system that is quite different and has a different image of me than the system that is in the transactional side of the fence. And she said, you're absolutely correct. The data that we have is a little bit old, and it's not always that these two systems are kept up to date. And we do this monthly quarterly data sync, but sometimes things fall through the cracks. And wow. that is when I decided, okay, so I said, okay, this is why data integration is important, because as a customer, I mean, I am what? I'm not even a rounding error with the 11th or 20th position after the decimal point in these guys' balance sheet. But I think I'm thinking this way. In this day and age, every customer counts, because you know you need to make sure that you serve every customer, not because of how much business they gave you, just because you need to treat them well, because they need to feel that you know they are important, and you know then that's when they will demonstrate the loyalty. So I think that's where, for me, I said, okay, the era of client server has produced so many data silos that people now are grappling with all these different data silos. And so there is this huge market for us to actually go into the space of data integration, because without data integration, you truly do not understand your customer. And if you don't understand your customer, then what chance do you have of understanding anything else in the business? And I think that's fundamentally where I believe the demand and the market for data integration is. And that's why I think that what I'm interested and passionate about is something that is worthwhile pursuing.
So you're basically looking for your next employment / opportunity, whatever.
We're always looking for the next opportunity, my dear friend.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Katja, for this. This was truly interesting. And I think many people should listen to your thoughts and considerations about this. I think you're onto something really important here in this age of many kinds of data from many sources.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me on this podcast and giving me the opportunity to share my thoughts. And as always, when we get together, we have fun. And hopefully the last hour and 55 minutes or thereabouts was fun for you.
It was very fun for me. Thank you so much. I am going to stop recording now.